top, tickety boo.
Good evening, one and all. I know another week's gone whizzing by. I was talking to my guests. I don't know where today's gone at all. It's just sort of evaporated. That's all I can say. I knew I was meant to do stuff, and of course, I haven't managed to do it. But then I've had a couple of busy days. My wife's 70th birthday on Friday, my daughter's 21st on Saturday, and my mother's 94th on Sunday. So a little bit busy and expensive, as you can guess. But I am here, and so is my guest. Now, my guest, what can I say? He's come a long way from writing about chicks. But we'll find out about that when we get to it. But when you've lived some sort of experience, and you sort of got this thing that you want to write, and you know you want to write it, perhaps it makes it easier if you've lived it. But then on the other hand, does it? I don't know. We better find out. I better ask my guest today, because on the show, I have the one and only William Maz. Hi, William. How are you doing?
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. My pleasure. As I said, bit of a long way from writing about baby chicks.
That's how I started my passion for writing when I was in Mrs. Garbutt's class in seventh grade, English class, and she asked us to write a short story, first one I ever wrote, and it was about three little chicks that that my mother gave me when we were living in a refugee camp in Athens after having left Romania. We actually stayed there 2.5 years, and these little chicks, it was winter, and unfortunately, they didn't survive. So yeah. That crushed me, and so I wrote a short story about that. I read it in front of the class. They applauded, and I was hooked.
You know, that's funny. I remember I had a lady on the show one time, an author, and she was telling me that her daughter had just become in kindergarten, had just become a best-selling author because they typed her story up and the kids gave, like, you know, a couple of cents for each copy. And so her daughter at the age of four had become a best-selling author in kindergarten. But it's amazing how many people, almost as soon as they can hold a crayon, you know, they've got this gene in them, this creative gene. And, you know, it looks from yourself, despite, obviously, your work is something you totally different on the medical side, but you've always had this sort of yearning to write from the sound of it.
I always did, and I kept it alive even though I was working hard, you know, as a doctor and training. I was always writing at night. I was taking writing classes both in college and afterward throughout medical school with Gordon Lish for a year, with New School and a writer's studio in New York. And so I try to squeeze in as much as I could about creative writing, even though I had to make a living and writers don't make a living. So you can say, well, there are easier ways to make a living, but not really from my point of view. My father was a doctor, my brother a doctor. So
Everybody
was a doctor.
You were sort of directed down that way from the sound of it.
Preordained, more like it.
Right. It's interesting that I reckon in the last sort of 20, 30 years, possibly more than that, there's been an increase in lawyers and doctors writing novels because, for a start, lawyers, after all, they're telling stories all the time, you know, in their line of work. And doctors, of course, now you've got the computers and the laptops, you don't have to try and read their writing anymore. So I think that's what it is. You know, as you said, you sort of followed the family to the medical profession and that. Were you able to sort of, you said you sort of did still study the sort of writing stuff, out of the... Did you start creating short stories or anything like that? Did you sort of work from that to your novel?
I started with short stories, and unfortunately what happened over the past, 50, 70 years is that a lot of magazines for short stories have disappeared.
Right.
There used to be Harper's Bazaar and all sorts of other magazines that would take short stories that would pay, Right now, there are very few places, usually literary magazines that, five people read. And for short stories, there aren't very many venues. So I started with short stories, of course, in classes and all of that. But I soon graduated to the novel because I figured that is the modality that would be published. And so even during my training, I wrote a novel in medical school, which actually had a I actually was able to obtain an agent for from ICM, International Creative Management, and she wasn't able to place it, but it almost got placed with Knopf. They just didn't like the ending, and I was too busy at that time in my training to rewrite the novel, so it didn't get published, but I learned a lot from it, and I've written two other novels before the Bucharest Dossier, which is the novel that we're now talking about.
Well, Bucharest Dossier, which came out, I think, March. So it's not been out
March
that long.
The Eyes of March.
There you go. I love the way it's described as a love story within a spy thriller within a historical novel. So it's like one of those Russian dolls where you've got...
That's exactly right. That's what I meant.
Great. And you mentioned before, and I said at the start of the show, the fact that you actually lived part through this terrible thing that was going on, you know, and you said you sort of ended up in Athens, isn't it, sort of thing like that. Did you find that you were able to, or did you? How can I put this? When you were sort of creating it and the characters and things like that, were you trying not to bring in your own remembrances, or were you trying to use your remembrances to massage in within the story?
Yes, let me. That's a very good question, and I have a thought out answer because it is a subject of great controversy in writing class when you start being a writing student, fiction writing, and you write a short story based on what you know because they tell you write what you know, right?
Yep.
So you start to write what you know, and you immediately get criticized because for many things, but one of them is that it doesn't have the structure of a story. And the inevitable response by the writer is, but it's true. That's exactly how it happened.
Right.
And that what the young writer doesn't understand is that a story has a structure to it. Life does not give you stories. It gives you events. It gives you scenes. It gives you random situations, random characters, random connections. You don't even know what you're really writing about sometimes until 10 years later when you look back. So when you are writing a story based on your life, you have to take the kernels, the diamond in the rough type of events that happen to you, and then form it, shape it into a story.
Yep.
Okay? So there are a lot of events that happen in my own life. For instance, Pusha, the love object, the girl that my character fell in love with when he was 8, and then had to leave her behind in Romania, in Bucharest, to come to eventually America. She remained she grew into an idealized mythological figure in his mind because it was so abruptly terminated. That girl existed in my life, but the rest of the story is fictionalized. I went to Harvard like the character, but the CIA never approached me to try to recruit me, but that is part of the book. So you use kernels from your own life, but you use them to shape a story of higher truth in it than the one you're given by life.
One of the things I found, speaking to some people on the shows, is that especially, well, there was one debut author I can remember just particularly, and she'd written a novel, and she, it wasn't too bad, evidently, from what the sound of it. But then she went to, a seminar thing, and there was this guest author saying, "Oh, when you do it this way, you've got to do it in this format and this tense and this thing like that." So she went home, and basically next 6 months basically rewrote the story to end up to following what she'd been told. And in the meantime, or that sort of time, she went to another seminar and somebody else told her to do something totally different.
Different, of course.
And in the end, she said, there was nothing of her basically left in the story. She literally hadn't, she'd followed this and followed that. And then she went back to her original story and she read it and she said, yeah, this is me. This is the story. This is what I'm trying to tell people. Well, she ended up getting it published. She ended up being very successful and doing several more books afterwards. But it shows you've got to have faith in yourself. If you follow everybody, you lose you within the story.
Well, that's the point, though. How much do you follow? There is no formula for writing a successful novel or whatever. There are many ways of doing it. In fact, I wrote the Bucharest dossier first. I wrote it in the first person, and then it ended up being rewritten in the third person, and I liked the third person better because it allowed me to do certain things, like tell part of the story from another character's point of view. Mm. So there are many ways of telling a story, you don't go to a class and then copy what one writer did. So you learn all the methods. It's like you go to see an early Picasso, you go to the Guggenheim Museum, they have those early Picassos. They look just like a regular portrait, like some middle, class impressionist would do. Mm. He hasn't found his style yet, but he was mastering the old style. So you got to master different ways of writing before you find your style and you find your voice and then you go off.
Indeed. Obviously, you go back to Romania and, the whole business of that when, from your own past as well. Obviously, with the whole Ukraine thing going on and the effects of that, it must sort of bring back a lot of memories, some of which you don't really want to remember.
Well, I mean, what you have with Putin is you have a revanchist kind of a movement, which means that they want to go back to an old state that they think was the height of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Putin said the greatest catastrophe in the 20th century was the breakup of the Soviet Union. Well, this has happened throughout history, where the old regime wants to regain the glory that it lost. And part of the reason I wrote the book is to show what a totalitarian regime looks like. And whether it's communist or oligarchy or any other name you want to call it, they're all totalitarian and they all use the same method. They all use propaganda. They all use the secret police, and they control. They control. Contraception, for instance, mm-hmm. in Ceausescu's time, it was illegal to have contraception and illegal to have an abortion. What ended up happening? The only form of contraception for women was illegal abortions. Mm. So it ended up that over the course of a lifetime, a woman would have between 20 and 30 abortions.
Wow.
One woman. Like sometimes she said, I would have 3 or 4 a year.
Yeah.
It was only form of contraception.
Right.
And you had the secret police tapping phones, following you. I'm sure I was followed during the times I visited there.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure I have a dossier. Everybody had a dossier. That's why it's called the Bucharest dossier. Dossier is file.
Yeah.
And the secret police had files on everybody. So, I could discuss it more, but I don't know if you have time.
No. I mean, one of the things I know, the thing that I remember about the whole issue with Romania at the time, they had I was back home in England at that time. The BBC did a big thing and huge thing about the children that were just being left in these basically. Well, homes, what they, for want of a better word, but they weren't exactly homes. They were just, you know, they just, I remember the film where there was like six babies in the same cot sort of thing.
It was a horrible orphanage.
The word, yeah.
And what happened was that the reason people were having so many abortions is because nobody wanted to bring any children up because there was famine, widespread famine. You had to stand in line for bread, for eggs, for anything. There was corruption everywhere, and nobody wanted to bring children into, so that the population was dropping. And so even if you had a child, were pregnant, many women left it in front of the orphanage and to be brought up because they couldn't afford to bring up a child. And so these children were housed in these orphanages. I remember you remember reading somewhere where they started having AIDS, these kids.
Yeah.
And how did they get AIDS, everybody was wondering.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you how they got it. Because some bright person in the regime wanted to make the babies look healthier, fatter, because they didn't have enough food to feed them. Mm-hmm. And people were coming to look to see if they could adopt one. So they started...
That's right, yeah. Yep.
They started transfusing them with blood. You believe it?
Yeah. That's where the AIDS came from, obviously, yeah.
And the blood came from people on sailboats, on boats coming into the port of Costanza from all over the world.
Right.
So, crazy. You know, it was a dismal country. And what happened, what's happening here in Russia is the same thing. You have propaganda everywhere. You can't listen to outside sources. You have a secret police, the KGB that was transformed into SVR or whatever they're called now. And, you can't even go out on the street and say anything against the government because you'll be arrested. So that is the typical totalitarian regime that I wanted to show and to American people to see what it actually looks like and feels like live in.
Indeed. And within that, as I said earlier, you know, you do have this love story. It is a spy thriller, obviously the historical part. And within this, the Bucharest dossier, you do sort of basically show that love can survive.
Love can survive. Love can survive any regime. And for my story, it can survive 20 years. And so the story is that this young boy leaves the girl that he loved very much behind in Bucharest, and he grows up in America, becomes a CIA analyst, and he's unique among analysts because he is running a mole inside the KGB, which he codenames Boris. And he doesn't know the identity of the mole. Boris just started sending him intelligence. And then the last piece of intelligence that he receives in December of 1989, when the book takes place, is come to Bucharest to create history, Boris says. You have to remember that by December of 89, all the former Soviet satellite countries had turned to democracies, mm-hmm. except for one, Romania.
Right.
And so my hero, Bill Heflin, goes to Romania to find Boris. And so Boris is the center of the novel. And Boris ties all the three parts, the love story, the spy thriller, and the historical part together and intertwines them.
That's great how you managed to use Boris to literally pull all the threads together, because that must be one of the hardest things when you're writing so many different parts You've got to have some sort of catalyst that brings it together. And you've not only got the Boris as the catalyst, but he was also a major character.
Well, he is the most loved character from everything
right.
I've heard from responses, and actually is my favorite character, because one of the things that Boris is he is a Russian, but he is my character is Bill Heflin's best friend and mentor. And Boris seems to know everything about Heflin. And whenever Heflin asks him, how do you know this? Boris is a comic figure. He says, I'm a spy. I keep telling you. I know everything.
Right.
So it's, Heflin realizes there are secrets on all these levels. There is the secrets as to the love part. Who is this girl, Pusha, and what has happened to her? Boris seems to know these things. Then what is his real mission? Why did Boris ask him to come there? And then the bottom, the historical part, for which I did a lot of research, is how did the revolution start? You have to remember, this is the only revolution that was violent and bloody of all the countries. And to this day, people in Romania keep having these discussions. Was this a real revolution or was it a coup? And if it was a coup, you know, who was involved? Were there outside forces involved?
Well, that's the thing. Were there outside, was it?
Yes.
Did you stand up or were you pushed sort of thing? Right.
Well, most of my research goes into describing exactly how the revolution happened. And I fill in, with poetic license, the gaps that history has not yet answered. And that is one of them. Who started the revolution
right.
and why? And
right.
another one is, whatever happened to Ceausescu's $1 billion offshore accounts? Nobody found them.
Mm. Yeah, this is... yeah, we know all about that now, but as you say, what happened about it during things like that, and you know, so many other dictator type things, that money just doesn't seem to be there, does it, when it happens? Yeah.
Well, that's because they hide it very well.
Indeed.
And they put it under other people's names.
Indeed.
Stuff.
So, we said this came out in March, Ides of March, as we said. What sort of response have you had from it?
I've had a very good response. It went through the first printing very quickly. It sold out.
Oh, good.
I got great reviews by well-known authors also. Some of them are on the cover of the book, actually. And in Amazon, it's like 4.5 stars. I got very good responses from
good.
It. Right now, I'm waiting for the second printing because... in printing, as in everything else, there is a delay because of personnel and logistical issues.
Yep, globally, yes.
Yes, so it's hard to get the hold of the book right now, which
right.
is kind of frustrating.
Now, I mean, while you're doing that, I assume you started on a second book?
Well, I've actually almost completed the second book.
Okay.
I'm waiting for the publisher to give me the response that they like it. The second book uses some of the same characters.
I was going to ask that, right.
Yes, as the first. And it takes place 3 years after the revolution, and the subtitle would be like The Rise of the Oligarchs.
Right.
Now, there are oligarchs in every country that used to be communist, because during the transition from communism to capitalism, the people in charge, and was usually the security services, like the KGB, which is what most of the oligarchs are in Russia. In Romania, they're called the Securitate, which is a secret service, so KGB-like. They are the ones that took over all of these companies that were privatized at that period, because they had all the power. They knew everybody's secrets, dirty secrets, in the dossiers that everyone had. And they were able to blackmail their way, politicians, judges, into giving them these big companies that were state-owned. So they became overnight millionaires.
Right.
and they exist to this very day. And people say they still control the government, no matter which government it is.
Indeed, sir. Well, it's been fascinating chatting to you about this. Really has. Time, as you said, you've got to watch the time. It disappears very quickly.
Yes.
But, William, what I'm going to do now, anyway, is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where people can find out more about you and, of course, your book.
Yes, thank you so much. It's the website is williammaz.com. It's one word, William, M-A-Z. .com, and you can find out where I'll be appearing, and you can get the book anywhere as soon as the second printing comes out, which should be any week now.
Okay. Well, William, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. It's been really interesting and pretty fascinating sort of going into you know, this sort of thing, especially with what goes on, is going on right now, and people tend to forget about some of the previous ones that went on, and the fact that you've managed to produce it into such a popular and looking very good best-selling type book. Great stuff, and good luck with the future books.
Thank you so much. I'd love to be back again and discuss the second book.
Indeed so. That's what I was going to say. When the book, second book comes out, just let me know and we'll get you back on the show.
That's great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Well, there you go. My guest today, William Maz. So it's William and then M-A-Z, or as I'd say, M-A-Z. Is Maz. And as he said, you can find his more about him and, of course, his book, The Bucharest Dossier, on williammaz.com. Very interesting, very good book, lots of great reviews, and a name to watch out for there, William Maz. Well, that's it. I'll be back again tomorrow with a fresh guest. But, of course, until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...